Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, November 5th, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is out working the elections. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at FranStorchND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So, health-wise, for me, I am probably getting stronger because I'm doing more things that maybe I shouldn't have been doing. Yesterday, I took some of my summer clothes downstairs and brought up my sweaters, and that was a lot of lifting, and I think I made my back sore by doing that, so I'm going to take it a little bit easier the next couple of days. I have not yet done my PT exercises today, although young Will is giving me loads of lovely exercises. The issue is he keeps layering more on, which means it takes me more time to do the whole set. But he also said, don't feel like you have to do every single one of them every day. And I tend not to do that. I mean, it's only 34 minutes, but on the other hand, it's 34 minutes. So fitting it in becomes an issue, especially waking up, you know, it's getting darker and darker in the morning, or coming upon the sunrise zenith of the year. The sunrise zenith of the year in Mansfield Center is 7:21 a.m. That's the latest that the sun will rise. And then the next day, it rises at 6:22 because we turn the clocks back. And then in January, we have another zenith, which is not as late as the one in October of 7:18 a.m. But what it means is it gets dark earlier and it stays dark later, which makes it so that I find that I'm sleeping longer. I'm able to sleep longer, and it's harder to get out of bed because when it's dark, I want to sleep. And so when we turn the clocks back, so when you're listening to this, it's November 5th. Clocks have already been turned back, and you might notice that the sun is setting in the 4 o'clock hour now. Yippee! And it'll be doing that until sometime in, I think, January, February. Oh boy. So it gets dark very early. You have to park your car closer to the office, so you're not walking in the dark as much, and that's something that I do. Anyway, so in terms of my health, my knee was kind of... When I walked a lot during the cyclocross race, and it made it so that my medial meniscus got pinched out, and it stayed inflamed for a while. And then the last couple of days, it's gotten a lot better. But I'm still going to see a doctor for my knee in the next couple of weeks. And so I'm going to get some care that way because it keeps happening and you never know when it's going to happen. And I can go from being able to go on long bike rides to being sidelined. So I'm going to get it taken care of. I've been doing exercises and acupuncture, which probably help, and as well as seeing my chiropractor. They all help. But you know, there's something going on in there that needs to be investigated medically. So I want to get that taken care of. And then as far as the numbness in my leg, it's still there. So I'm going to see my APRN, Tamika, soon, and we'll talk about it. And I'll make sure that I'm on track and that this is okay and that I'm not, I don't like need an injection or something. Because I know I have a friend who has chronic back problems. She's already had a fusion and she gets injections too. So I don't know if I need that too. I'm hoping that that it was okay to get this laminectomy, and it's not true what UConn said, that really I needed a fusion. So I'm hoping I don't have to have a fusion because the recovery is just so much worse for that. As I'm watching Ron recovering from his fusion, it takes months and months and months and setbacks and moving, you know, back and forth and forward and back and like that. So, so the other thing I'm going to do, and I'll talk about this next week, but I'm going to start taking a senolytic product. I saw it advertised on TV, which made me then want to go and research what is a senolytic. So I have to look into it a little further. And it's interesting because it's a bunch of antioxidants that you take, and you don't have to take them every day. Depending on the product, you might take it once a couple times a week. once a week or once a month even. And so I'm going to, so it has interesting antioxidants in it. One of them is fisetin, which I have to look up and learn more about. The other thing is I had a question from Eric out in Washington, who is my dear friend for life, and he wants to, he's not feeling his workouts the way that he would like to. And so he thinks that it's a nutrition problem, and I'm wondering if he's undercarbing before he works out. And that's a problem. So I'll talk about that next week as well. I've got other things planned for today. So, and in terms of Ron, poor Ron, he's been very stressed because he's working the elections and he's teaching classes. And so he's very, very busy, and he's getting, and so he's been getting some cramping, and he hadn't had cramping in a long time, and now he's getting it. And I think it has something to do with the stress, and maybe something is out of alignment. I'm not sure. I'm wondering if it's time for him to go back to the chiropractor. So those are some things I wanted to talk about, but some of those things are for the future. Okay, so the next thing I wanted to talk about is something very, very sad. A beloved fellow who I used to broadcast with at WHUS, Ken Steeplejack Ferguson, passed. And he had moved to Massachusetts. He lived locally, and for a long time he was one of the pastors at the Storrs Congregational Church, and then eventually left the Storrs Congregational Church, and he moved to Massachusetts, and he lived up there, and then he started to experience a lot of health issues. And interestingly, I never lost touch with him. He had me on Facebook Messenger, and he would check in with me periodically, and he would ask me medical questions, and I would help him out and give him some advice and chat with him, and he would update me on what was going on with him. And he, you know, there's nothing wrong with his brain up until the very end. Then all of a sudden, in the last week or two, I got a note, it was posted on Facebook, that he had passed. And so I really loved Ken because he was a Christian, and he was a type of Christian that I really admire. He really loved Jesus, and he loved Jesus the way I think of Jesus, which is the Jesus of loving kindness and the Jesus who fought for injustice. And that was how he saw Jesus. And he really, really loved Jesus that way. And it made him a better person, and it made him a kinder person, and it made him somebody who really had no problem speaking out against injustice. And I'm sure he was having a really hard time with the political situation right now and the way that Christianity is being presented in the media right now. And I mean, his Jesus is similar to the Jesus that's on South Park right now. It's very interesting. So one of the things that happened was years ago, 10 or more years ago, when I used to do my show in studio. Now I make my show remotely since the pandemic. That's what I've been doing. It's easier for me because I can make it on any day and then broadcast it another day. But when I used to be live in the studio for a long time, Ken had his show right before mine. And so I would get on the air and he would stay and we would chat for a little. We spent 5 or 10 minutes chatting on my show, which some people thought was okay and some people didn't think was so great. I loved doing it because I thought that, you know, spirituality is part of natural healing, and I enjoyed the banter. I enjoyed chatting with him. And so when we had that crossover, he was Steeplejack and I was the radio naturopath. So we called it the Steeple Path. And I really enjoyed that. He had and I'm going to have to ask staff at WHUS if they still have a recording of this, but he had an opener for his show that he played every week. And it was a pastor whose name I do not remember. And it was a great segment. And the segment ended with the pastor saying, "Here's a tip. If you're killing somebody in the name of God, you're missing the message." And I loved that. And I told him how much I loved it. And I heard it every single week. And I would always listen to it and I'd tell him about it. So I'm going to find out because I went online to figure out who it was so I could read the passage to you. It was a pastor preaching. And I can't remember who the passage was, what the passage was, or the preacher. And so I'm going to see if we have a recording of it at WHUS, and then I'll either play or record or read the whole thing. But it was so meaningful, and it really spoke about Ken's relationship with Jesus and God. So he had a really solid, healthful, spiritual relationship with God. And he really saw the difference between religion and spirituality, and that he was a very spiritual person. And he was also very concerned that Christianity was changing, and that it wasn't changing, and that Christianity really needed to change with the times, because they were losing adherents, and they really had to change with the times and look at what's going on in today's culture and meet culture where it's at, so they could attract more people. And so he had a very youthful and very forward-thinking way of thinking about Christianity. And it was really beautiful. And I really loved him and admired him for that. And I'm very, very sad that he's gone, because he really, really didn't have it easy. He had some serious, I'm not going to tell you what the health issues were, that if you're on Facebook, you might be able to find that information. But he got dealt a bad hand ultimately in terms of health. And he really had to struggle at the end. And I don't think he was that old when he passed. I'm guessing he was in his late 60s, early 70s, which is youngish. You know, but although it can happen if you have serious health conditions. So miss you, love you, Ken Ferguson. I call on spirits and angels to be with me. Whatever you believe about that is whatever you believe. But I talk to my dad all the time, and I talk to my beloved friend Charisse a lot. And then I shout out to my grandparents and my aunts and uncles who have passed. And now I'm going to shout out to Ken Ferguson, and, you know, to watch over me and be with me. And again, whatever you believe about that is fine. And if it gives you comfort, I think that's a good thing. So Baruch Dayan HaEmet, which means blessed is the true judge. That's something that Jewish people say when someone has passed. And I'll say a Kaddish for you, Ken. I'm sad. Oh, I will miss him. So if you're listening to this show on the day that it dropped, it's November 5th, Guy Fawkes Day, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but I want to say a special shout out to my dear friend and former drama and choir director, Thomas Cardia. It's his birthday today. Mazel tov. We celebrated his 80th last year, and he's still healthy and spry and gardening and doing and making cool Italian stuff and baking bread and, very interested politically and really out there, and he's a good guy, and he lives up in Massachusetts. Hopefully at some point I'll be able to visit him once I get my, I'm just hoping I can get my orthopedics healed, because once I do that, I'm going to be able to be more out and about and traveling and stuff. Right now I'm doing a lot more resting than I would like, or maybe is good for me, although I need to do it so I can heal. And I'm wondering if I'm setting myself back in my back because I'm doing too much. And yesterday, I think I lifted more weight than I should have. So anyway, all right. So let's get on to some of the things we wanted to talk about. Let's talk about Guy Fawkes Day, because if you're listening on November 5th, it's remember the 5th of November. And it's generally a British observance. Although I will tell you, when I lived in Newfoundland, it was a huge big deal there. They called it Bonfire Night, and they'd light these great big bonfires, and everybody would go out, and, you know, in Newfoundland, people like to drink, so they would drink. And it's cold out on November 5th. If you think it's cold here on November 5th, it's even colder there. I mean, people think of Newfoundland. So Newfoundland, I lived there for a year and a half. I lived there from August of 1995 to March of 1997. And everybody thinks, oh, it's so far north, it's got to be really cold up there. And it's no colder. It really isn't that much colder than here, because for two reasons. First of all, you think of Newfoundland as being way far up north. Well, that depends on your definition of north, because Newfoundland, latitude-wise, is at the same level as Washington State. And did you know that Halifax, Nova Scotia, the city of Halifax, Nova Scotia, which you think of as being way up there, it's out there in the Maritimes, it's in the Atlantic province. Halifax, Nova Scotia is south of Salem, Oregon. So you don't realize that, you know, the northwestern United States goes all the way up to the 47th or so parallel. And that's where Newfoundland is. And I'm not sure what exactly where St. John's is. St. John's is in the south. It's the very, it's the extreme south, southeast corner of Newfoundland. And it's a big province. It takes 8 hours to drive across it from St. John's to, say, Cornerbrook. And then another 4 hours to get down to Port-au-Basque, which is where you get the ferry to go to Nova Scotia. So Port-au-Basque is the southwesternmost part of Newfoundland, and that is where that's the closest point to Nova Scotia. And then, of course, if you go due north, then you're in Labrador, because the province is not actually Newfoundland. It's Newfoundland and Labrador. It's all one province. And that's the eastern, Labrador is the easternmost point on the continental part of Canada. And then you leave Labrador and you're in Greenland. So anyway, and so there's a lot of Inuit and Inuit people up there. So in Labrador, and of course, then you get further north and a little bit west, and then you're in Nunavut. And of course, Nunavut has its capital Iqaluit, there's a lot of Inuk people there as well. So anyway, Newfoundland also had the Beothuks who died out, but there's an active Mi'kmaq population in Newfoundland as well. Meanwhile, Newfoundland, because it was the most recently added province, it was part of the British Empire until 1949, when Confederation happened. So Newfoundland became a province of Canada. Newfoundland, now Labrador, became a province of Canada in 1949. That's when Confederation was. Newfoundland was discovered by Giacomo Caboto, also known as John Cabot, in 1497. So anyway, so because they were added so recently and they were under the auspices, they were still colonized by Britain, they have, first of all, their dialect, because they're isolated, they're the way they speak is very different than the rest of Canada. And so they sound very much like West Country of England as well as Ireland, because there's a lot of Irish descendants and they're pretty genetically homogeneous up there. So and because they're on an island, the way they speak is not it doesn't sound as modern as they do in other provinces. And it's amazing how it sounds. So if you see the play Come From Away, you'll hear some of that. The way they speak in Come From Away is really not what you would expect to hear in the outports. People who live in St. John's kind of sound like that. They sound more like the rest of Canada with that a bit of a Newfoundland twang. If you watch, what is it? Critch, Son of a Critch, which you can see on Netflix. Son of a Critch is set in Newfoundland too, and the father in Son of a Critch works for the radio station VOCM, which I used to listen to. It's a real radio station, and the logo is the real logo as I remember it when I was there. So he works for VOCM, and the thing is that most of the actors on Son of a Critch are not Newfies. The only actor who's Newfie is Mark Critch, who it's based on his life, and Mark Critch is the son. He's a young boy in this show, and his father is played by him, Mark Critch, the guy who developed and created this show. And the show is filmed in St. John's and in and around St. John's, which is very cool, and other towns near the Avalon Peninsula, which is where St. John's is. But if you listen to how Mark Critch speaks, his accent is a pretty classic St. John's accent. And everybody else, the kid who plays him as a child, he's British, and the way he speaks, he sounds like sort of generic North American, and so does everybody else. Most of the other people, that's how they sound. And most of them are not Newfies. So what are you going to do? And they didn't force them to have Newfie accents. Once in a while you hear one, but Mark Critch is the only one who consistently, Mark Critch, the actor who's playing Mark Critch's father, he's the one that sounds like a Newfie. So anyway, so the whole point was that Guy Fawkes Day is a big deal in Newfoundland. So here's what Guy Fawkes Day is. It's about the gunpowder plot. And the conspirators were Robert Catesby. They were zealous Roman Catholics who were enraged at King James I for refusing to grant greater religious tolerance to Catholics. They planned to blow up the Houses of Parliament, which is at the Palace of Westminster, during the state opening of Parliament, intending to kill the King and members of Parliament in order to clear the way to reestablishing Catholic rule in England. The plan failed when the conspirators were betrayed, and one of them, who was Guy Fawkes, was taken into custody the evening before the attack in the cellar where the explosives were used to be stashed. The other conspirators were either killed resisting capture or, like Guy Fawkes, tried, convicted, and executed. In the aftermath, Parliament declared November 5th as a national day of Thanksgiving, and the first celebration of it took place in, get this, 1606. We think we're an old country. We are so not. Today, Guy Fawkes Day is celebrated in the United Kingdom and in Newfoundland, and in a number of countries that were formerly part of the British Empire, with parades, fireworks, bonfires, and food. Straw effigies of Fawkes are tossed on the bonfire. So there's always an effigy, and this is, you'll see this anywhere there's a bonfire, you'll see this effigy of Guy Fawkes. They're tossed on the bonfire, and as are, in more recent years in some places, those of contemporary political figures. Oh dear. Traditionally, children carried the effigies, called guys, through the streets in the days leading up to Guy Fawkes Days and asked passerbys for a penny for the guy, often reciting rhymes associated with the occasion, like Remember, Remember, the 5th of November, the best of known, which dates from the 18th century. Here it is. Remember, Remember, the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason, and plot. We see no reason why gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. I didn't know that part. I just remembered the first part of it, because I learned that from... I am not sure if I learned that from Russell when I was with my, I had a fiance named Russell who was British, and he knew about Guy Fawkes Day, and then I got to Newfoundland and it was a big deal there as well, so I'm sure that Bill taught me that as well. So fireworks are a major component of Guy Fawkes celebrations, representing the explosive that were never used by the plotters. The guards perform an annual search of the Parliament building to check for potential arsonists, although it is more ceremonial than serious. Louis in southeastern England is a site of celebration of Guy Fawkes Day that has a distinctly local flavor, where they have six bonfire societies. Memberships are grounded in family history, set for generations. The gunpowder plot, which is this conspiracy of English Roman Catholics to blow up Parliament and King James I, his queen, and his eldest son on November 5th, 1605. The leader of the plot, so I'm kind of repeating myself. So there's a lot more to this, and I'm sure you want to hear more about health and stuff. So we'll move on. But just so you know, if you're listening today, it's November 5th. Happy birthday, Mr. Cardia, Tom Cardia. And it is Guy Fawkes Day. So if you can light a bonfire if you want to, or you could have a pit fire, or maybe just go light the stove downstairs if you want to, or wherever your stove happens to be. Or you could even light a candle. If that's easier for you. I have so many candles. I keep, because like if I go to the farmer's market and there's a local artisan who's making all natural candles, I like to support them. So I buy these candles and then I have a lot of candles. I just really, and I tend to light candles more when it's cold out because they do impart some warmth. I'm always amazed when I light the Hanukkah, the Hanukkah menorah, as I'm carrying it from the kitchen to my bedroom. I'm amazed at how much heat that it gives off. And so lighting a few candles can give off heat. Just make sure if you're lighting candles, you're lighting them safely and they're not near something that can catch fire, and that you watch them as they're burning, because if they burn too low and there's nothing but liquid wax in them, then they can also catch fire, and the glass that they're in can catch fire. I had that happen to me. I burned my hands. I fell asleep when I had a candle in a glass burn, and it started to flame out the top, and it singed a plant that I had. And thank goodness I woke up in time, or else my apartment would have burned down. That was a long time ago, and I had to go to the ER because I had my hands were, I'm like, why do my hands hurt so much? Maybe there was some toxins in that wax. It's not very good wax, but I had second degree burns. So I went to the hospital, I went to the ER, and they took care of me, and my hands healed. I used to have discoloration that I no longer notice on one of my hands because I got tanned on that hand, And it would tan excessively in the spot where I had the scar from the burns. But I don't notice that anymore. I should look at that and see if it's still there. But I think it healed over time, which is great. Okay, so that's the deal with Guy Fawkes Day. All right, so we were talking about menorrhagia, which is excessive menstrual bleeding. So let's talk about natural health and how natural health helps with menstrual bleeding. So according to the World Health Organization, 18 million women aged 30 to 55 years perceive their menstrual bleeding to be excessive. Clinical reports demonstrate that 10% of the women experience blood loss severe enough to be clinically defined as menorrhagia. It's defined as prolonged or excessive menstrual bleeding that occurs at regular times each month with a blood loss greater than 80 milliliters, which is 2 to 3 ounces or a quarter cup per menstrual period, or having a flow lasting more than 7 days. In comparison, a normal menstrual period has a flow of 25 to 80 milliliters and can last anywhere from 3 to 7 days. So 80 milliliters, it's supposed to top off at 80 milliliters, which is, so 80 milliliters is only a quarter of a cup all those days. And that's all the fluid that you're getting out. That's pretty amazing. So there's a lot of causes of excessive menstruation, including uterine fibroids, polyps, endometriosis, endocrine imbalances, trauma, infections, cancer. Dysfunctional uterine bleeding is defined as excessive uterine bleeding that occurs in the absence of an underlying medical condition or structural abnormality. And you can only use that term DUB when those other causes of excessive menstruation have been ruled out. It can occur with or without ovulation and can occur at any age, but most commonly in adolescents and perimenopausal women. About 20% of DUB cases are adolescents after their first menstrual cycle. They're due to an immature endocrine system, most notably an immature hypothalamus, and perimenopausal women account for about 50% of DUB patients because of decreased ovarian function. So why would that happen? Because when you're perimenopausal, you have stopped ovulating. And when you don't ovulate, the only way for you to get progesterone, there's only two ways to get progesterone. One is to ovulate, because the corpus luteum, after you ovulate, makes progesterone for you. And the other way is to be pregnant. And that's because the placenta makes lots of progesterone. And progesterone's job is to create a nice bed for embryo to implant. And it helps the endometrial lining to stick together. So if you don't have progesterone, but you still have estrogen, you're building a uterine lining, but it doesn't hold together well. So it will come out and it won't stick together so well. And it'll come out and it'll come out runnier and with more blood. And then if it bleeds too much, then you'll get clots. So the categories of DUB, menorrhagia, metrorrhagia, menometrorrhagia, and intermenstrual bleeding. So we're going to mostly talk about menorrhagia. So how do you know if you have it? It's likely that we're talking about 10 to 20% of women in the U.S. who have it. I was fortunate that I did not have it, but I have had so many. The reason I'm talking about it is because I have so many patients who have it that I'll come in, I'll check somebody's iron levels, I'll see that they're low, and then I'll check to see if they had reported that they have heavy periods, or if I don't know, I'll ask them, do you have heavy periods? And most of them do. So, they also, it tends to be genetic how much menorrhagia you have. Women often feel embarrassed to ask people and talk to people about their periods. So they may experience it for many years and never tell anybody. That's why they think that the numbers are higher than what we think they are. So you want to get a hold on it earlier rather than later, because if you have menorrhagia, it can be an obstacle to conception, because if for whatever reason you're bleeding out, you probably have a progesterone imbalance and you need adequate progesterone to hold your uterine lining together. And it's the most common cause of anemia in premenopausal women. What's anemia? Anemia is defined as a deficiency of hemoglobin and hematocrit, that you have a low hemoglobin and hematocrit. Hemoglobin is the red pigment in all of your red blood cells. Its job is to run around and pick up and drop off oxygen through your body. Hematocrit is a measure where you take a sample of whole blood and you spin it down in a centrifuge, and the heavier elements are going to drop when you spin it down and the lighter elements are going to rise. So what happens is the red blood cells are at the bottom of the tube, and the everything else, the water, the platelets, the white blood cells, the proteins, the serum, everything that's in the serum, your minerals, all that stuff sit at the top. And so what you can do is you can measure in the tube that you've spun down, you can measure a percentage of the tube that's taken up by the red blood cells. And if they're below a certain level, then you're considered to be anemic. So that's how they figure it out. So if you only have a little bit, if most of the tube is white, then you're more likely to be anemic. But if you have a decent amount of red in that tube, a good percentage of it, then you're not anemic. So signs and symptoms, that's if you're soaking through a sanitary pad or tampon every hour for several consecutive hours. So it's defined as blood loss greater than 80 milliliters over the course of your flow. So the Diva cup holds an ounce of menstrual flow, which is 30 milliliters. So if you're having to change it twice in a day and it's full both times, you've already reached 60 milliliters. So if you're changing your Diva cup more than three times or more in a day, you could have menorrhagia. A super tampon holds about 0.3 to 0.4 ounces, which is three separated saturated tampons, or six per quarter cup. And a super plus holds a little bit more, 0.4 to 0.5 ounces. And so if you're saturating a pad every hour, then you're probably bleeding too much. So if you need to double your sanitary protection to control your menstrual flow, so if you're using two tampons, or if you're using a tampon and a pad underneath of it, or if you need to wake up to change sanitary protection in the night, if you're bleeding a week or longer, if you're passing large clots, if you're restricting activity because of your heavy menstrual flow, if you have symptoms of anemia like fatigue and tiredness or shortness of breath. A common finding with menorrhagia is passing of blood clots, and there are varying medical perspectives as to the cause of clots. One view is that the clots form if blood accumulates faster than the body's ability to transfer it out of the uterus through the cervix. As it pools in the uterus, clots form. Another theory is that the body releases anticoagulants during a woman's period that are designed to keep the blood from clotting, and if you have heavy flow, the blood may be expelled too rapidly for the anticoagulants to work. So then you will form clots. So many women experience clots during their period, which doesn't necessarily mean you have menorrhagia. If you have a few little clots, that's not a big deal. But if you have clots that are big and they're difficult to pass, then you could have menorrhagia. So, and you want to talk about the size and the amount with your physician. So if you're suffering from menorrhagia, you want to make some dietary changes. So you want to have things that both help to that promote healthy clotting, but also make it so that your blood is it's a little on the thinner side, so that you don't have these bad clots. So you want to eat fruits and vegetables, stuff that's high in vitamin C, because that's going to give you more integrity to your blood vessels. Whole grains, which is, if you eat whole grains as opposed to refined ones, you're going to have better hormonal balance, because your excretion and your management of your hormones through your stool is going to be better. And eat fish that's high in omega-3 fatty acids, which reduces inflammation and again helps with the integrity of cells, including blood cells, including the cells of your blood vessels. Legumes, which are high in fiber and are going to give you a good balance of probiotics in your digestive system. And then iron-rich foods. Don't forget about nuts and seeds, which are going to give you more fiber, and they're also going to give you lots of vitamins and minerals, including iron. And then specific iron-rich foods like brewer's yeast, wheat germ, and blackstrap molasses. Only eat wheat germ if you're not gluten intolerant. Make sure the wheat germ is organic, and do store wheat germ in the fridge if you're going to eat it, because the oils in it can become rancid. Reduce your saturated animal fats like those in beef, chicken, and dairy, so you have good prostaglandin formation. So prostaglandins are, they're little tiny locally used hormones, eicosanoids, that are made very close to where they're used. Whereas in your endocrine system, you'll make, for example, thyroid hormone, which gets released by the thyroid gland, which is in your neck, and it's used all over your body. Whereas eicosanoids are released by glands right where they're going to be used. So they're released in the gut and they're released in the uterus and they're used right there. So if you have too much saturated fat, apparently you don't make as good healthful prostaglandins. So then you want to eat organic as much as possible, because the organic, if you don't eat organic, the pesticides and possible added hormones are going to compete with your natural hormones for health. And your body is going to have to work twice as hard to excrete those extra hormones. So you don't want to add extra hormones, antibiotics, and other chemicals that are going to worsen your menorrhagia. And you don't want your liver enzymes to have to, if you want them to properly manage the hormones that you already make in your body, you don't want to have extra hormones on board from outside sources. So don't eat your food intolerances. If you eat foods that don't work for you, your menorrhagia is going to be worse because you're going to have more inflammation. When you have more inflammation, you have more of the wrong kind of eicosanoids, and you're going to be more likely to have menorrhagia and also dysmenorrhea and cramping. So anything that causes inflammation in your body is going to make the situation worse. Alcohol, again, alcohol is going to compete with your liver's resources for managing your hormones. So drinking a lot of alcohol is going to give you more excessive bleeding and more blood flow. All right, so supplements. So some of the supplements that you can take, flavonoids and vitamin C. So when I offer vitamin C to my patients, my favorite vitamin C to offer is one that also has a lot of bioflavonoids. It's a very absorbable vitamin C that comes from mineral ascorbates. So it has magnesium, potassium, and calcium ascorbate. And so mineral ascorbates are more readily absorbed. And if you have more of a variety of mineral ascorbate, like if you take Ester C is calcium ascorbate. But you can get mixed ascorbates that have those other minerals. So zinc ascorbate, calcium, potassium, magnesium ascorbate. So if you do that, it's kind of like when you have a phytosome, that the body's interested in taking up that phosphatidylcholine to give you more, building blocks for making cells. So if you take mineral ascorbates, your body really wants those essential minerals. It needs to use calcium, magnesium, and potassium. So the transporters that take on those minerals will carry the ascorbates into the cells as well. And you're going to get better absorption if you do mineral ascorbates. And the other thing is bioflavonoids. So the bioflavonoids could be rutin, hesperidin. And you can also get special bioflavonoids. There's bioflavonoids that have been studied. There's a combo that has been studied. It's diosmin with a specific amount of diosmin and with a specific amount of hesperidin in it. And those bioflavonoids, I'll give that supplement to people to help them reduce their bleeding. Sometimes it's not enough, but both those are things that can be helpful. Because those flavonoids, again, what bioflavonoids do is they help, and vitamin C, they help with the structure, the collagenous structure of the blood vessels and make them stronger. And they also reduce inflammation. There's a lot of ways that vitamin C and bioflavonoids work. So heavy menstrual bleeding, of course, can lead to iron deficiency anemia, but it's not as well recognized that iron deficiency anemia can cause or worsen menorrhagia. Iron deficiency can cause your muscles of the uterus to weaken, reducing the ability of the muscles to clamp down on blood vessels. So you start by bleeding too much, and now you don't have enough iron, and then that loss of iron makes the whole situation work. So it's a vicious circle, it's a spiral. So one of the things I do is I get my menorrhagic patients to, I check their iron to see if it's low, and then if it is, I'll usually give them iron to take, and I'll also suggest that they eat iron-rich foods. So we talked about brewer's yeast, grass-fed beef if you can tolerate it, and nuts and seeds have a decent amount of iron in them, as well as spinach. So you get this spiral. So heavy bleeding can worsen your iron deficiency, which then worsens the bleeding. That there's the vicious cycle that I talked about. So you want to help treat that. That's why generally, if you're having menorrhagia, I'm probably going to put you on a supplement. So vitamin A, research has shown that vitamin A deficiency impairs hormone production and enzyme activity in the ovaries of animals, and the mechanism of vitamin A and blood loss isn't clear, but it seems to have a complex interaction with estrogen. So the administration of estrogen has reduced the serum vitamin A levels of animals, and women who have menorrhagia have been found to have lower serum vitamin A than healthy women. So a deficiency in vitamin C, zinc, protein, or thyroid hormone may impair the conversion of carotenes to A, which creates a deficiency in vitamin A. So I will give people vitamin A to take. And someone with menorrhagia, they should be checked. I probably would not bother to check their vitamin C levels because they should be taking it and eating it, so it doesn't really matter. Zinc I might check, and then I would talk to them about eating protein. People don't always eat enough protein, and most of my patients, unless they're doing a ketogenic diet, they don't get a good amount of protein. Women tend to be afraid of protein because they think it has a lot of calories in it. And yet, it's probably the thing you should be eating the most of. When you go to a nutritionist to talk about fat loss, and also a personal trainer and talk about fat loss and nutrition, they often increase your protein. And of course, protein is a craze right now. And the way it's happening is they're putting all these protein supplements into snack foods and bars and all kinds of things where, like, you go to the cafe and you can get protein powder in your coffee. I don't recommend that so much. I mean, I think if you're gonna, I do take a protein shake every day, and I'm pretty confident that the protein shake is pretty clean. But I have one scoop of that a day, and then I'm not gonna get protein. I'm not gonna have protein thrown into my my coffee if I go to the cafe. Although I might get the delicious fizzy, the foam on the top, the flavored foam. I do enjoy that. But women tend not to eat enough protein, and you need protein to help you. You need protein. You need amino acids to make your clotting factors, because there's proteins and enzymes involved. So vitamin A is one of the things we give for patients who have excess bleeding. If you have a deficiency in B vitamins, your liver can't inactivate estrogen as well. And B6 is an important one there. And that can result in an estrogen excess. So if you're estrogen dominant and not enough progesterone, you're going to have an overgrowth of an unhealthy lining, which is going to come out faster. And you're going to have more menorrhagia. So a B vitamin supplement can help restore your liver's ability to metabolize estrogen. So it can help reduce your menstrual flow. Vitamin E reduces capillary fragility, encourages the production of healthy prostaglandins. So when you take vitamin E, please make sure it's not synthetic. So you don't want to be taking DL-alpha tocopherol. And it's even better not to take just straight up D-alpha tocopherol, which is natural vitamin E. It's a good idea to take vitamin E in the form of mixed tocotrienols. So you can get a nanotocotrienols or a vitamin E that contains tocotrienols. That's the form that you want to take. Vitamin K. So it's rare to have a vitamin K deficiency, but it does help with clotting factors. You can supplement vitamin K, and the vitamin K that you want to supplement is actually K1, and it can be helpful for reducing excess menstrual loss. And if you eat a lot of leafy greens, you'll get vitamin. There's a lot of vitamin K in leafy greens, so you can eat salad greens, and you can eat heavier greens like collards and mustard, and turnip greens, and all of. Vitamin K is present in a lot, and kale, it's present in a lot of healthy leafy greens. Ginger. Menorrhagia is believed to be due to an altered prostaglandin 2 ratio, and ginger has been seen to inhibit the synthesis of the altered ratio of prostaglandin synthase and cyclooxygenase. So if you have too much cyclooxygenase, you're going to have more blood thinning and you're going to bleed out more. Cyclooxygenase is the compound that aspirin blocks so that you have less inflammation. So ginger helps to work with that. And ginger, instead of being hard on your stomach and giving you ulcers, it's very good for your stomach. And so if you like ginger, getting ginger in your life and in your diet and sometimes in your supplements can be helpful. Vitex annus cactus, which is chaste tree berry. And it's the best known herb in Europe for managing hormonal imbalances. And it helps the hypothalamus and pituitary glands to increase LH and inhibit to an extent FSH release. So that helps with a shift in the ratio of estrogen to progesterone, helping to reduce menstrual flow. So what it's going to do is that you're going to be more progesterone dominant and less estrogen dominant. It's also been shown to inhibit the release of prolactin. So if you have too much prolactin, too much prolactin is going to inhibit your estrogen. So when a woman is under stress, Vitex can help with that. And it can take a while for it to work, actually. There's also shepherd's purse, cinnamon, and yarrow. And I have a compound that I give to my patients that has vitamin A, vitamin K, vitamin C, and all of those herbs. Cinnamon, yarrow, shepherd's purse, and I'm not sure if it has chasteberry, but it has the other ones. And then other supplements to think about would be fish oil, because fish oil is going to reduce your inflammation. So is flaxseed oil and even primrose oil. And they encourage beneficial prostaglandins. So you're not going to have the inflammatory ones, and you're going to have more of the anti-inflammatory ones. You can also use bioidentical hormones if you have to. And so lab-manufactured hormones are derived from Mexican wild yam or soybean and are biologically identical to the progesterone in a woman's body. Natural progesterone substitutes for lack of progesterone due to insufficient ovarian production, and it's several times less potent than synthetic progestin, and it is bioidentical. So be aware that synthetic progestins are used for contraception. If you take progesterone, it is not, if it's natural progesterone, it's not contraceptive. So be aware that if you're taking it and you're not taking other blocking hormones, you can still get pregnant. In fact, women who are progesterone insufficient and are trying to get pregnant, they give them progesterone to take. They might give the progesterone in suppositories or gels that go on the cervix, so the way that you can take progesterone, I'm not a super big fan of progesterone cream that you put on your skin because the absorption can vary. I think you get more consistent results if you take the progesterone orally. So progesterone can be administered orally. You can get oral micronized progesterone, which is usually in peanut oil. So if you're peanut allergic, tell your practitioner that if you're going to take oral progesterone, it has to not be in peanut oil. So you can get pills. The thing with progesterone pills is that it has to do that first liver pass. So you have to swallow it. It has to go into your stomach, and then it gets broken down by first level of liver enzymes, and then you have metabolites, and then it gets broken down a second time. And so you have to take a higher dose of it. But for a lot of women, that's an easier way to go. And I have patients who take oral micronized progesterone, 100 to 200 milligrams, and it does what they need for them. It helps the menopausal symptoms. It helps their menorrhagia, helps them to get pregnant. My preference is to do sublingual progesterone oil, which you do have to get compounded. You can also get it over the counter. And there's a certain level of strength that you can get over the counter, and you can't get above that. But if you get it from a compounding pharmacy, you can get higher levels. And then the cool thing about sublingual oil is if you can take it in drop dosages, you can titrate your dosage. You can figure out a dose that works for you. So you get a certain level of the progesterone. If you get it from a compounding pharmacy, I used to get it a long time ago, and it was raspberry flavored. So you can get it flavored if you wanted to. And I would get raspberry because somebody told me raspberry was the best. So I did. And then if you put it under your tongue, you're putting the same exact amount under your tongue every single time, and you have a lot of blood vessels under your tongue where it can be absorbed. And because you're not swallowing it, you're not dealing with that first liver pass. So it's, you don't have to take as high a dose, and it's going right into your bloodstream instead of having to be metabolized by your digestive system and your liver. I mean, it will eventually get to your liver, but there's no first pass. There's only the first pass that happens, it's going right from your blood. It's not going through the biliary system at first. So progesterone can help when you take natural progesterone, of course. Progesterone helps to knit together that uterine lining so it holds together better, and you don't have as dramatic bleeding when you take it. Remember that stress will eat your progesterone. So if you are stressed, so if you're still in your menstrual years, you're trying to ovulate. When you ovulate, if you ovulate, then you have the splitting of the ovum. You have half of the ovum becomes, well, half of the follicle, I'm sorry, it's the follicle. Half of the follicle becomes the ovum, which is the future potential baby, and half of it becomes the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum stays in your ovary. It makes progesterone for you, has about 2 weeks of progesterone in it. And if you get pregnant, then once you have no more progesterone from the corpus luteum, the placenta starts taking over. If you aren't pregnant, then you have no more progesterone from the corpus luteum and you eventually get a menstrual period. So what will happen is once you start releasing progesterone, if you are stressed, your body may decide it needs cortisol. And there's an easy two-step process to convert progesterone to cortisol. So if you're stressed and your body thinks you need extra cortisol, it'll take the progesterone, turn it into cortisol. So you have energy to run away from the bear, because cortisol's job is to run around your body, break down tissue, turn it into sugar, so you have energy to run away from the bear. Or, you know, take care of your kids or your parent or whatever it is you're doing that's causing you stress. So if you are very stressed, taking progesterone can be helpful, because progesterone itself is calming and you'll have an extra stores of progesterone. So even if you convert some of it to cortisol, you'll have extra. And also because it will help to knit together that endometrium. Oops, we had a little fall here. Because it helps to knit together the endometrium, then you are going to be less likely to have excessive uterine bleeding. All right. If one of the things you have to check when somebody has excessive menstrual bleeding or when they have any kind of hormonal anything is the thyroid. I check TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, which comes from pituitary and causes the thyroid gland to make thyroid hormone. I check T4 and I check T3 to make sure people are making enough T4 and that they're converting that T4 to T3. The other thing I check in everybody, unless they tell me not to or they don't have good insurance or whatever reason, but I screen everybody for thyroid antibodies, because I have caught people's Hashimoto's thyroiditis and I have caught people's cancers. So I check everybody, and I do that because good old Dr. Kreitzer, who finally retired, who's an endocrinologist, I noticed that he monitored people's thyroid cancer by checking their thyroglobulin every month. And I said, oh my goodness, well, I should be screening everybody for thyroglobulin antibodies because they might have cancer. And guess what? Some of the people I checked had cancer and they didn't know it, because people don't routinely get screened for thyroglobulin antibody. So anyway, if you're hypothyroid, you're going to be more likely to have dysfunctional uterine bleeding. So when my patients come in, as long as they have insurance or want to be checked, I check their thyroid. And for everybody, because everybody, says a lot of people have fatigue. If you have hormonal anything, one of the things you need to check is thyroid function. So I absolutely check it, treat it. I treat it naturally if it's slightly out of range, and I have them go to get prescribed if they need to. And I don't have prescriptive authority in the state of Connecticut, so I will send them to someone who does and can prescribe for them. Then there are Chinese herbal formulas, and I can't tell you the exact compounds that are used, but if you have a blood deficiency, and so you have a blood deficiency and you probably have conception vessel issues and governing vessel issues. And anyway, somebody who's familiar with Chinese medicine can tell you more about that. But I'm a big believer in acupuncture. Shout out to my acupuncturist, Nicole, who I saw yesterday. It was very nice. I love going to see my acupuncturist. It's a great rest for me, because she does a lot of stress reduction points. Anything I have going on, blood pressure, pain, stress, liver function. You know, after my surgery, she did some points for liver detox to get the rest of the drugs out of my body, all kinds of good stuff. So I'm a big fan of Chinese medicine. If I had had the money, I would have stayed in Oregon longer and gotten my acupuncture degree, and that's how much I believe in it. If I ever have the time, I've often said that I will go back to school and get my LAC, but I'm not going to do that right now. Other treatment considerations for dysfunctional uterine bleeding. Like I said, acupuncture is helpful. Acupuncture and Chinese herbal medicine. Body-mind stuff. Anything that reduces stress is going to help you with dysfunctional uterine bleeding, because you're going to lower cortisol. Remember that cortisol, one of the things it does, when you're stressed, nature doesn't want you to try to have a baby. So cortisol suppresses your reproductive hormones. So if you can have better reproductive hormone function, then you're going to have less dysfunctional uterine bleeding. So the best way to lower cortisol, what's the best way to lower cortisol? Anybody? Bueller? It is deep breathing and just basically being still, but deep breathing. However you get to deep breathing is great, whether it's box breathing, 4-2-6 breathing, 4-4-8 breathing, meditation, guided meditation, yoga, especially the more meditative yogas like yin yoga and restorative yoga. Those are going to be really helpful. So reducing stress, anything that integrates body, mind, and spirit, cranial sacral therapy, Reiki, zero balance, healing touch, you name it, any of those. And then the conventional therapies, NSAIDs, well, I suppose NSAIDs are going to be helpful if they reduce inflammation, but that would not be something I would generally recommend. Oral contraceptives, if you got to take them, they work. I mean, because they short out all of your reproductive hormones and you have higher levels of estrogen and fake progestin and you don't ovulate at all. And so you ultimately have a small, thin uterine lining that when it comes out, it you don't have menorrhagia. So that actually works. And IUDs will work as well. You can have a dilation and curettage, which means they dilate your cervix and they scrape out the uterine lining as it is at the moment. Endometrial ablation, where they go in and they cauterize the endometrial lining, and you may not get periods anymore and you probably can't get pregnant. So they cauterize the uterine lining to cut off the blood supply to the endometrium, and then you don't bleed it so much or anymore. And you can also get a hysterectomy. And if you get a hysterectomy, if possible, try to have them leave your ovaries in so you can still have hormonal cycles. So make sure, once again, I always say as a caveat, don't just listen to me here. If you're listening to me and you're trying to get medical advice from me, you should be listening to me and thinking that this is education and that you should do further research and that you should go to a medical practitioner who will take care of you, your needs specifically. Don't think of what I do as medical. And, you know, I say that in my disclaimer at the beginning and the end of the show. Speaking of the end of the show, that was a good one. So I'm going to let you go. Remember the 5th of November. Enjoy a little Guy Fawkes celebration if you can. Unless you're trying to avoid alcohol, maybe have a little bit of a drink tonight, but not too much. Anyway, so you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.